Press Conference USA on the Voice of America. Newsmakers from America and around the world speak with journalists in an unscripted and unrehearsed discussion about the critical issues facing the United States and the world. Here is your host on this edition of Press Conference USA, Carol Castiel.
Welcome to Press Conference USA on the Voice of America. Joining me on the program is Shatarupa Barua, broadcaster in VOA's Bangla service. Our guest on this annual edition of the program is Amy Zalman. She's CEO and president of the World Future Society. The World Future Society is a nonprofit organization that tracks current and future trends in world affairs, science, health, economics, and politics. Among some of the World Future Society forecasts for 2015 and beyond are: the talent shortage in the United States and other developed countries will grow as baby boomers retire and younger workers fail to pick up the needed skills. Advances in artificial intelligence could create a rapidly accelerating economy, but one that pushes more human workers aside. And we will engineer ourselves to be ageless and disease-free. I want to know more about that one. And listen up, leaders of China. Social media will become increasingly important in political uprisings. On this edition of the program, we'll talk with Amy Zalman about the implications of these and many other social, economic, and scientific trends in 2015 and beyond. Amy Zalman, welcome to the program.
Thank you for having me.
And I'm delighted to welcome my colleague, Shatarupa Barua from VOA's Bangla service.
Thank you, Carol.
Well, Amy Zalman, it's a delight to have you here, and I'd like to tell our listeners that up until now, we have been talking with your predecessor, Tim Mak. So we welcome you to the show and as CEO of the World Future Society. Remind us what World Future Society does and how it does its work. Talk a little bit about your methodology, your membership, etc.
Thank you for asking that question. The World Future Society is the world's longest-running and largest membership organization supporting and nurturing futurists. For us, futurists are anyone with an interest in their own, their community, their national, and the global future. And we have thousands of stakeholders and about 6,000 to 7,000 members around the world. We have, as you know, been publishing and a content provider for many years, most especially our Futurist magazine. We also hold an annual conference. This year it will be in San Francisco, and it is about making the future, something that I think is important to the whole world. In the coming years, as we begin to become even more attuned to our global membership, we are hoping to take those conferences abroad and outside of the United States.
And quickly, Amy, what about methodology? I mentioned a number of forecasts in the introduction. How do your members and scholars, futurists, go about coming up with some of these forecasts?
Futurists have a very wide range of methodologies that they use, from scenario planning, which is a long-term process, to using science fiction as ways to explore with potential with clients or with stakeholders, in particular futures, how they might look. Increasingly, methods are immersive and object-oriented, meaning that people create rooms or spaces or online spaces where people can feel and touch the future as opposed to simply thinking about it.
All right. And one more question before I turn to Shatarupa. As we enter 2015, what, in your view, are the most striking trends that you see on the horizon, be they political, economic, scientific, or otherwise? And how might they change our lives?
Well, there are surely important trends in all of the areas that you mention. Governance globally is such a big issue. Increasingly, as we think about in the realm of the serious problems or challenges like climate change, a rising population, possibly 9 billion in the foreseeable future, issues like resource deprivation, water, shifts in the production of energy and things like this. We think that for us, for futurists, there are, of course, technological answers and fixes to a degree out there, but we're interested in the future of how people, communities, and their governments and segments of society, like public and private sector, will be able to work together. Governance is always a challenge, so we're interested in trends there. Obviously, there are big technological changes up ahead. We wrote last year about the incredible shrinking size of computer chips. Artificial intelligence seems to be moving at a faster and faster developmental pace, and this has substantial societal effect. In the United States, there is real concern at this point that robots will truly take over people's jobs, and I'm sure that kind of concern will rise in other countries as well. It already exists in some other developed countries.
All right. Let me turn to my colleague Shatarupa for a question.
Thank you. I would like to ask you about this artificial intelligence because that reminds me of something Stephen Hawking, the British physicist, said several weeks ago. He warned that artificial intelligence might just be the end of humankind. And that is because artificial intelligence has this competitive advantage in terms of evolution over human species or any other species per se, because biological species usually takes several thousand years to evolve from one generation to the other, whereas artificial intelligence can evolve over a period of several years, even several months from one generation to the other. So do you think that besides robots taking over human workers' jobs, artificial intelligence would be the dominant form of intelligence in the world?
The theory that it could is certainly out there. Increasingly, futurists, scholars like Nick Bostrom, also an English philosopher, talk about things like superintelligence, an argument over something called the singularity, the point at which humans and machines might actually meld and become a different kind of creature, have been around for some time. The question is, how soon? Of course, people's time frames vary significantly. Are we really around the corner from some kind of machine world that actually looks a little bit like a movie and starts eliminating human life? Or is it really something that will evolve down the road? It seems to me that it strains logic to really look at the most movie-like, horror movie-like version of this. But it seems absolutely true that we will increasingly ourselves be using artificial intelligence not only to support ourselves around us, but sort of on and in our bodies as well. There are examples of that already, and it seems as though there are more to come. There is an interesting study we also wrote about last year as a potential trend for the future in which people will have exoskeletons that are automated. Wouldn't it be great for those of us who at least struggle to go to the gym or to exercise, to have an exoskeleton, a soft one that we could pull on and use? And there are more serious applications as well for people who may be frail, for defense, and for other industries.
Amy, let me turn now to another forecast that you made, and that is that drones will become vital tools for environmental management and protection. So here we're talking about drones, which we normally associate with national security and obviously some of these so-called, you know, targeted killings, but now using them perhaps in a positive way to help stave off environmental degradation, et cetera. What about that particular trend?
There's no question, I think, that it will grow. The potential for drones is really amazing and fabulous. When we move away from the realm of defense and their use in that capacity, we see that the fact that there are these very small machines that can be inexpensive and lightweight, to which we can affix various kinds of measurement tools, make all kinds of measurement of the environment that we wouldn't normally be able to see possible. So we can do all kinds of monitoring on behalf of ourselves, on behalf of the environment, that we could not do before.
Now, speaking of the environment, you talked about climate change, and here's a question that speaks to both climate change itself and the kinds of political decisions needed to stave it off. We note that China and the United States last year announced an agreement whereby China intends to achieve the peaking of CO2 emissions around 2030, which is supposedly a big deal, even though there are many critics saying that, well, they could do that earlier. To what extent will this have an important impact on climate change and trying to reduce these various greenhouse gases that are negatively affecting our planet?
Well, first, the example of China and the United States is such a perfect one when we talk about future trends and the importance of focusing on governance. The problem here setting aside the facts of climate change for a moment, are about governments recognizing that they need to work together and that they need to work with various segments of society. And it's not only the China and the United States, it's many countries. Our challenges in this realm lie in figuring out not technological fixes, but how we are going to create diplomatic and political and social solutions to understand how climate isn't governed by borders. Second, the fact of climate change is the kind of change that futurists like to talk about a lot because it is game-changing. Although there are many forms of planning in which people, any business, any family, any country sort of looks ahead and says, wow, what is going to happen in 5 years, 10 years, 15 years? There are some events, especially as the world and the environment grow more complex and interconnected, that are serious game changers. So whether it's 2030, whether it's 2040, whether it's 2025, the kinds of changes, like the sorts of extreme weather that climate change can bring about, are ones that we all really need to pay attention to and at least game out. If they don't come true in the ways that are most negative, then we can be thankful. But if they do, we will, I fear, be sorry that we didn't plan or think about those better.
So are you hopeful that this agreement between the United States and China is potentially game-changing, and that it could serve as a model for other countries that may be dragging their feet, such as India, those countries that say, well, we have to develop, and they see some sort of contradiction in helping to reduce greenhouse gases and develop at the same time?
I think it's an important step, and it is especially important that it is, in this case, the United States and China, two obviously sort of heavyweights in the world. What countries need to recognize is that climate change doesn't obey national borders. And that's the important part, not so much that one country or another has to come up with a technology. The same exists in disease.
You're listening to Press Conference USA on the Voice of America. Our guest is Amy Zalman. She's CEO and president of the World Future Society, and we are discussing major trends for 2015 and beyond. I'm Carol Castiel, along with Shatarupa Barua. She's broadcaster in VOA's Bangla service. This is a reminder that our PCUSA podcast is available for free download on iTunes. You can find the download by clicking on the iTunes tab on our website at voanews.com/PCUSA. You may also follow me on Twitter at Carol Castiel VOA, or connect with us on Facebook via Carol Castiel VOA. Or you can send feedback via email to PCUSA@voanews.com. Tell us where you're from and how you listen to the show. Here's a shout out to a loyal listener, Alphonse Nkongolu from Congo, Kinshasa. And before I turn to my colleague Shatarupa for a question, Amy, give us the website for the World Future Society so our listeners can take a look.
If you permit me, I'd like to give you two. Our website is at www.wfs.org. You can also learn about how we are developing our membership and our services throughout the world at www.supportwfs.org.
Thank you very much. We'll put that on Facebook and Twitter as well. But now a question from Shatarupa.
This is regarding the education system. I was glancing over your Outlook 2015, and one prediction is that teachers may be glad to be replaced by machines when it comes to grading papers, and artificial intelligence will offer fairer, faster scoring. But we are still talking about, seems like, standardized grading system, standardized testing. My question is, this education system, this system of public education, was introduced by the advent of Industrial Revolution to sustain a particular culture, a workforce that is very relevant to the industrialized society. But now that we are in this information society, in data society, where everything depends on your access to data, and there is more emphasis on creativity, customization over massive conformity. So do you think we can anticipate major changes in the education system in near future?
That is such a wonderful question, Shatarupa. I agree with you completely. I will say that having taught in a university, I would have liked a machine sometimes to help me grade. But that aside, absolutely, it may be the case that at the lowest sort of level denominator of standardized testing, we will be able to use machines, even as we do now, to help us with simple tests. But what's much more interesting is what you're talking about, the way in which globally education systems and the way in which we societies think about education needs to change. One of our interests at the World Future Society is entrepreneurship throughout the world. So if it is the case that in the future we will, as we talked earlier on the show, have a lot more automation and robotics and artificial intelligence doing some simple tasks globally, all over the world, we are going to become dependent on the, as you say, creativity, intelligence, capacity to put together disparate things in order to create new ones, new systems, new processes among our youth and people older than that as well. So what kind of educational systems will support or processes will support students in their lifelong quest to be entrepreneurs and to work together and with technology in new ways? We'd love to see how this develops. We're watching it in not only the United States, in fact, not least, but places like Central Asia and Africa and elsewhere.
We're also seeing that e-learning is kind of replacing the classroom setting. And a student is no longer limited by the physical mobility. So that's a great trend that we have been noticing lately.
Sure. The capacity of mobile devices and ever smaller devices to bring information to students or people and to help them communicate with each other is of great interest. It remains to be seen, and it's something that I hope that we dedicate more attention to in the coming years. What makes an education? How much does it matter for people to be truly in presence of each other? And how much can you replace it with people being on screens with each other?
That's a very good question. And a related question, Amy, one of the forecasts for 2015, you say that the talent shortage in the United States and other developed countries will grow as baby boomers retire, you know, people in their 60s, and younger workers fail to pick up the needed skills. I detect a bit of a discrepancy based on our conversation, because does that mean that younger people who are generally extremely talented, especially on social media and using the tool of social media, does that mean that we are not educating them properly to replace the retiring baby boomers?
Well, to earlier points, probably the skills needed. I mean, I agree with you completely. The mind of an 18-year-old is almost innately creative and kind of ready to go, as is a 25 or a 30-year-old. And for those of us who are older, we're not so bad either.
Thank you.
We're doing okay. But this whole conversation has almost been about how we are still feeling our way around what kinds of skills we need. So I wouldn't move so quickly. We could talk about the failure of schools in one context. But in the context we're talking about almost globally, I think the whole world is feeling around for what it is we need to train people to do, because the world is changing so quickly.
No, I agree with you. And I think that there is a lot to be said for a more mature workforce, the experience, the background that comes with an older person. There's nothing to replace that kind of judgment, really. And it'd be great if we could, you know, try to incorporate that in our education systems, teaching younger people in addition to the social media, the digital skills. I have a question about health. As we look around the world, whether it's the terrible Ebola outbreak in West Africa or the unfortunate trend toward dementia and Alzheimer's disease in more developed countries among older people, what do you see on the horizon with respect to breakthroughs for drugs that can help either prevent or slow down these types of diseases, or a better caring for people?
Well, once again, I think that this is a story partly of technology or of the capacity of science and scientific advancement to help us. It's also a story inevitably of politics and of figuring out, for example, how to distribute and how to experiment appropriately with the kinds of solutions, the kinds of cures or inoculations that can be come up with. I think that was one of the most salient stories last year in this unfolding story of Ebola. Were questions about how to make sense of quickly developed and still experimental drugs as we develop them. And there also seems to be an important story in the fact that more international cooperation at the level of science and the level of that kind of applied scientific work is probably important as well, and a trend that we would encourage.
Now a question from Shatarupa.
You mentioned politics and governance quite a bit of times. And my question would be, growing disparities in wealth portend increased potential for civil war. That's one of your society's prediction. I was interviewing a South Asian security expert not too long ago, and what he mentioned in that interview is that radical organizations are using this sense of growing disparities in wealth among the younger people as a recruiting tool. So it's not just civil war, it's terrorism, it's fueling terrorism. What do you think? What's going to happen in future?
Unfortunately, I have to say that I think the story of exploitation of gaps between the rich and the poor is not a new story at all. It's existed as long as class has, which is pretty long time. And I don't disagree at all with the fact that non-state groups and militias can exploit gaps as well as can any insurgent or, you know, sort of existing fractures in a state as well. There are some predictions, which are not happy ones at all, that suggest that the rich-poor gap globally will only increase and it will become more extreme. What we see now is sort of nothing yet. And what that means for any of us is really, I don't think, been fully thought yet. And not only in the realm of war and politics, what does it mean for work? What does it mean for how we care for people? What does it mean for the power of a fewer and fewer wealthy individuals or groups to make decisions on behalf of the rest of us? So a lot of stuff needs to be thought about what is happening economically and whether we can think new things about what wealth and value are and what equality is. Maybe our systems of thinking have been outgrown by the way in which we do business.
Well, speaking of the political realm, Amy, what about the prediction that social media will become increasingly important in political uprisings? I mean, we have seen social media play a role, but it's a catalyzing role, but then things sort of fall apart. We take note of the aftermath of the Arab Spring uprisings. Instead of bringing to the fore more liberal governments, we saw the rise of Islamists and then the fall of Islamists, now a rise in autocratic leadership, sort of back to the future, whether it's been in Egypt, perhaps Tunisia is a bright spot. And of course, China is the one to watch, you know, to what extent social media is going to be a catalyst for political change.
I think it's true. It's self-evidently true that social media plays a part in uprisings. The question, as you imply, is what happens next? Two people who talked about it in a very interesting way were Eric Schmidt, Google's head, and Jared Cohen in their book 2 years ago, The Digital Future. And they talk about the fact that it's relatively easy to whip up, and this is what happened in the Arab Spring, get people to the point of what we would actually call a revolution or an uprising, depending on where you sit. But the question then is, then you need leadership. And you need operational capacity to move forward into the next stage. And we're in as old-fashioned a place as we ever were when it comes to that.
Indeed, I guess the Hong Kong, the so-called umbrella revolution is another example. But I think that these are early days and we'll see how things play out, perhaps for the better or for greater change. And what about the trend toward lower oil prices and what impact might this have on many oil-rich countries, whether in Africa, Nigeria, Angola, the plummeting prices, we see what's going on in Russia. What is the significance of this?
Well, that's a much shorter term question, and we usually deal in longer term ones. But I will say the unfolding shifts in energy production are really a set of interesting questions for governments and for consumers.
It'll be interesting to see if this trend, should it continue, prompts some of these oil-rich countries to diversify their economies away from fossil fuels. Another question from Shatarupa.
I will go back to Outlook 2015 again. And over here, you mentioned science collaborations may bring distrustful nations close together. You specifically cited the example of relationship between North Korea and United States.
You cannot get more distrustful than that.
Okay, I will get into Sony hacking incident. This was an act of retaliation because Sony was about to release a movie called The Interview, where the story contains a plot to kill the North Korean leader, Kim Jong-un. So here, what I have been noticing is that the science is kind of amplifying the tension between these two nations. So do you still think that science collaboration will be able to build a bridge between North Korea and the United States?
Absolutely. I mean, if I could, these are two different things. Even futurists think about the past sometimes, and this was a happy story between the Soviet Union and the United States. It's really the case that when you can bring specialized professionals who don't have their eye particularly on political tensions, but who want to get work done together, that there's always an opportunity for collaboration and cooperation. And the fact that we can now create social networks with much greater ease and personal connections is a great boon. It's one of the happiest stories I can think of regarding social media, to have them collaborate across national boundaries. The question of what unfolded with Sony, what that told me, if it were true, was how important culture and pride and a whole host of other emotional and collective psychological questions, how much they mean to folks, because that's a lot of trouble to go to create a specific kind of cyber blast that brings down a whole company.
And Amy Zollman, as we close, I would like to end on a potentially universally uplifting note, and that is your prediction that we will engineer ourselves to be ageless and disease-free. Please explain.
Well, wouldn't you if you had the tools?
Absolutely. So give us some more specifics.
I think this goes back to these questions of the singularity and the hope, that interesting concept that we will meld with machine. What if we create, grow organs that we could replace as ours kind of age out, as they inevitably do? Barring that, I have high hopes that the makeup industry will continue on its happy course.
Better wrinkle creams in future?
Indeed.
Amy Zollman is president and CEO of the World Future Society. Amy Zollman, it was a delight to have you on the program. Thank you so much for coming in.
Thank you for having me.
Press Conference USA on the Voice of America was produced in Washington. Thanks to Anna Zalewski for booking our guest. Our engineer was Curtis Bynum. And joining me on the program was Shatarupa Barua, broadcaster in VOA's Bangla service. I'm Carol Castiel. Join us again next week for another Press Conference USA on the Voice of America.
Press Conference USA on the Voice of America. From Washington, D.C., the nation's capital, the Voice of America has brought you Press Conference USA. You can email your questions or comments about this edition of Press Conference USA to PCUSA@voanews.com. And to keep up with all the latest news, tune to the Voice of America on radio, television, or the World Wide Web. Join us again next week when another newsmaker speaks with journalists about the critical issues facing the United States and the world. We'll see you next week for another edition of Press Conference USA on the Voice of America.